Good morning. Please turn in your Bibles to the 25th chapter of the book of Matthew. Matthew, the 25th chapter. Before we get started, I want to thank everybody for their prayers, for their messages of goodwill, for the cards that you sent and the calls that I received. I appreciate so much the outpouring of support and encouragement that you gave me during my recent illness. It is going to require some changes on my part. I'm on some different medicine, and they tell me it's going to take a little while to get to where I feel back to normal, taking this new medication. But it is also going to require some lifestyle changes. To everyone's surprise, I didn't require a stent or open heart surgery, but he said those lifestyle changes are ones that I'm going to have to make. And I want you to do me a favor. If any of you notice that I get so skinny that I can't drink red soda pop because I look like a thermometer, or if I get so skinny that I got to jump around in the shower to get wet, please let me know, because I don't want to get that unhealthy by getting too thin. So if you'll help me with that, that'll perhaps be one of the best things that you can do to encourage me in that. I want to lose weight, but I sure don't want to waste away to nothing, which somehow I think that's not going to be a problem. In the 25th chapter of the book of Matthew, stories told about 10 virgins. Says the kingdom of heaven will be comparable to 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. 5 of them were foolish and 5 were prudent. For when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them. But the prudent took oil in flasks along with their lamps. Now while the bridegroom was delaying, they all got drowsy and began to sleep. But at midnight there was a shout, "Behold, the bridegroom, come out to meet him." Then all those virgins rose and trimmed their lamps. The foolish said to the prudent, "Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." But the prudent answered, "No, they'll not be enough for us and you too. Go instead to the dealers and buy some for yourselves." And while they were going away to make the purchase, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the wedding feast, and the door was shut. Later, the other virgins also came, saying, "Lord, Lord, open up for us." But he answered, "Truly I say to you, I don't know you. Be on the alert then, for you do not know the day nor the hour." Cultural circumstances being different in that day and time than they are in our own, perhaps this parable requires a little bit of explanation. In some ways, we in America may not understand this as well as some people who are scattered around the world, in countries that we consider third world countries, or because many times their customs are more related to ancient customs than our own. Someone once said about America, we are not so much a culture as a way of getting by without one, because we have people who, instead of coming from a common background, have come from many different countries and many different places. By our constitution, we are allowed to have our own consciences satisfied through religious beliefs that can't be threatened by the government. And that doesn't mean that God accepts anything, but it does mean that our government does not have an establishment of religion. That diversity, in some ways, has some advantages. It also has some disadvantages, because it makes it more difficult for us to talk about a single American culture with its customs, with its traditions, than it does in many other countries of the world where there are traditions that go back centuries or millennia that people continue to follow. In the first century, if indeed you wanted to get married, probably the first person that you would talk to would be your parents. Now that may sound a little bit strange to us, but most of the time that happened. There were occasions, as there are in countries where marriages are arranged today, situations in which you might have people meet without their parents' supervision and fall in love that way. But for the most part, if you saw somebody that you liked the looks of, you would approach your parents and see if they could approach their parents. And if everything was satisfactory to both of them, a meeting might be arranged so that you could get to know the person that you were attracted to by seeing them. On other occasions, parents would decide that it was time for you as a male or a female to marry, and they would arrange something, usually from families that they knew and had a great deal of confidence in. The community and the family was much more involved in the first century in a marriage than it is in our particular culture. In fact, they thought of marriage as being the uniting of two families and clans and into a single community rather than it just being a contract between one man and one woman. So generally, if you had a situation in which your parents had arranged a meeting, or you had been able to see someone you would like to meet and they arranged a meeting, you would have several other meetings, some in which you might even get to talk almost alone with the person that you were interested in marrying. Usually the parents would still be in the house. They might be in another room and might, if they trusted you, allow you and your beloved to be in another room, of course, with the door open so that everything would be open and above board. But under those circumstances, if it seemed to be satisfactory, if it seemed that the families were compatible, if it seemed like the couple were compatible, they would arrange a betrothal. A betrothal, in many ways, was a ceremony in which you had this man and this woman and this family and her family basically making the agreement that a marriage would take place, often as much as a year in advance. That marriage then would be something in which during that period between betrothal and between the time that you began to live together as husband and wife was a time in which people on both sides of the family would basically begin their work of uniting these two families. One great advantage to that for the married couple was the fact that if you didn't have a good job, they'd try to make sure that you got a job. May not be with your family, might be with her family. If you didn't have a house, they would try to work out a situation where one was purchased for you. And everybody in the extended family would chip in. If you didn't have furniture, they'd provide the furniture. Almost everything was set up so that a young couple could be married and not have some of the difficulties of struggling financially during those first years, which, frankly, in our culture is one of the things that winds up destroying many marriages almost from the outset because they are worried about money. That was something that in that year of betrothal was worked out, and it also provided more and more opportunities for the bride and the groom to be able to get to know each other better. It was such a binding situation in a betrothal that to terminate it was considered divorce in the ancient world. They didn't understand it as a divorce in the same sense that you couldn't get betrothed to someone else, but the same word was used. In fact, you remember in the first chapter of the book of Matthew, when Joseph, who was betrothed to Mary, found out that she was with child, decided that he would put her away secretly. And that word, that root word, apoluo, is the same word that is used in Scripture for divorce. So there was a sense in which they understood that betrothal to be so binding, even though no physical relationship would begin for months or maybe even a year, You had such a commitment made, such a contract that had been brought together. The families had already begun to mail their property to the extent that it took a legal document to be able to break the bond that you had sworn to earlier. When all of those things were taken care of, then the marriage would take place. Marriage customs varied to some extent in areas of the ancient Middle East, but we can get a pretty good picture that maybe helps us understand what's going on in Matthew 25 a little bit better from being able to get the few hints that we get from works that deal with manners and customs in Bible lands, and from other passages in Scripture that gives us little hints about the way things operated. When a marriage was finally going to be ready to be consummated, what took place was, as you would have with a great deal of ceremony, the bridegroom going to the home of the bride to take her back to his home as his wife. Sometimes the marriage ceremony would take place at the wife's parents' home. Sometimes it would take place at the groom's parents' home. But it was a situation in which a great deal of those situations were very highly scripted, were very important, were seen as valuable traditions to be considered. You would have friends of the bridegroom usually attend to him. First time I went to Ethiopia, one of the young preachers there was getting married, and I was able to go to the wedding where he married a young lady who was a Christian there. And guess what they did? You had him and his friends. I never saw so many people. I know of one Christian. No, I know of two Christians that own cars in Ethiopia. They must have rented cabs. But every friend this guy had got in cabs and showed up at the bride's house. But they didn't just walk right on in. His friends escorted him into his house. And I never saw a black gentleman look so pale in my life as that fellow walking very slowly and seriously into the house of his bride, where there before all of her relatives he was going to be on display, and they were taking this very, very seriously. After the situation had been taken care of there, which lasted about an hour, which is probably similar to the situation described here, you had him walk with his bride, and instead of going immediately back to his parents' home, what happened was they went from there to the church building where the marriage ceremony was to take place. And again, all of this was done with great solemnity. Now, it was Africa, so in the background, you had people who were beating drums, and you had people who were singing African songs. It sounded like the Lion King in the background. But you had the bride and the groom walking, taking very slow steps. Looks on their faces were like they were going to their execution rather than to a marriage. And they walked back very slowly so that they could get in the car together and drive to the place where the wedding ceremony was to take place. Apparently, what is described here in the parable of the 10 virgins is a situation in which that process had already occurred. That the marriage was to take place at the home of the bride, and then the groom would come with the bride to his parents' house, where you would have, some places it would be at the ceremony would be at the husband's house, sometimes at the bride's house, but whatever the case, you would have the bridesmaids who would be out there to greet the couple. They would come in, and once that was done, the door would be closed, and you would have the wedding banquet. And the wedding banquet would certainly last way into the evening, way past midnight. And sometimes in the Middle East, these kind of banquets last for 7 days of feasting and dancing. Now, we're not talking about men and women dancing together. We're talking about the men dancing together and the women dancing together. But it is an outpouring of joy over the fact that this couple has found each other, that you have two families who have merged to form an alliance that is as strong as blood. Here you have a situation in which we see the tail end of that ceremony where 10 virgins, parthenoi, which in Greek was something that indicated that somebody was physically a virgin, but it also means that they were an unmarried person. So here the bridesmaids are ones who have gone ahead so that they might be along the pathway that the bride and groom would follow, and that they would greet them as they went into the house to the banquet, and there they would be enjoying the banquet. Now let me mention two other things. One thing that was important about this situation is similar to our culture, as varied as that may be. Young women really like to go to weddings because very often that's where you found your potential spouse. Have you ever known people who met at friends' weddings and then within a year they wound up getting married themselves? You see, that's not something new. That happened in ancient times too. So that's why young women especially really wanted to go to these weddings, because it gave them a way to scope out the hunks who were there at the wedding. When everybody is wearing their best, when everybody is wearing their wedding clothes. And sometimes it was such a serious thing that white wedding clothes were provided for everyone who had been invited. A second thing to keep in mind is that in ancient times and in the third world, time means nothing. It's one of the things I love about Africa. You can go there and time stops. You can say that we're going to meet at such and such for the assembly so that preaching will start at 7 o'clock. Nobody has a watch. There's not a clock on any one of the walls of the houses. So people basically kind of get there when they get there. I had a meeting one time in Ethiopia. When we first got there, there were about 150 people. By the time the second person had finished preaching, there were 450 people there as they sauntered in. Now, let me tell you, you've got a watch. You've got a clock on the wall. You don't have any excuse for sauntering in late. They do. But it also made for some insecurity about when all of the ceremonies were going to finish at the bride's house and the groom was going to come to basically begin their life together with feasting and by bringing her into the house of her parents, of his parents. Here you had 10 bridesmaids who have come. And they don't know exactly, because time meant nothing to them, when the bridegroom was going to come with his bride to his parents' house. So they purchase oil. Now, the word used here for lamp is a little different than the one that is normally used. There is a word that liknos in Scripture that talks about, it is normally the word used for a clay lamp that it has a basin and you put a wick in it. The word here is the word lampas. It's just a transliteration in our language. We call it a lamp. And it really had more like what we would consider a torch. It was a clay sphere sometimes with holes in it that could be placed on the end of a torch. It was soaked. You had rags that were wrapped around it that would be soaked with the oil that had been placed in this sphere, and people could set that on fire. Now, you had to replace the rags, and you had to replace the oil on a regular basis to keep that going. Imagine, people, especially as it gets dark, as it gets close to midnight, you're needing light. And every time, in fact, there were plenty of false alarms. The bridegroom's coming! People light their lamps and he doesn't come. And over the course of time, when the women were asleep, and they finally hear the final call that the bridegroom's on his way, five of them were running out of oil and didn't have lamps that they could use to light the way for the bridegroom and his bride. Five of them had brought flasks of oil to be able to put in their lampas so that they might be able to lead the way into the procession. The ones that were foolish say, "Please give us some of your oil." And they say, "There won't be enough for us and you if we do that. So, you need to go to the dealers and see what you could find." And oddly enough, sometimes caterers would be open all night during a wedding feast that was of major prominence. But they may have had to wake up the dealer who was so interested in business, he was willing to get up out of his bed, sell them some oil so they could have it. But do you know what happens? Is they got back too late, and when they tried to get in, they knocked on the door and weren't allowed in because they are told, "Truly I say to you, I do not know you." And they missed out on the wedding feast, and they missed out on everything that was associated with it, including the potential of meeting your husband in the future. You notice this parable ends with the warning. That's a spiritual warning. "Be on the alert then, for you do not know the day nor the hour." I want to finish with three things I want to leave on your mind as you think about this ancient wedding. You don't know the day or the hour that the bridegroom is going to come and take his bride, the church. And there are several things that are necessary for you to consider because you don't know the day or the hour. First thing you need to consider is the gravity of the situation if you miss out on the day and the hour. You remember in the 22nd chapter of the book of Matthew, it tells there a story about a king who gave a wedding feast. And when the time came, he sent out his slaves to call those that had been invited to the wedding feast. But they were unwilling to come. He said, "Tell those who were invited," verse 4, "Behold, I have prepared my dinner. My oxen and my fattened livestock are all butchered, and everything is ready. Come to the wedding feast." They didn't eat meat every day. They didn't eat meat every week. And here you have butchered livestock ready at this feast. But they paid no attention, and they went on their way, one to his own farm, another to his business. And the rest seized his slaves and mistreated them and killed them. But the king was enraged and sent his armies and destroyed those murderers and set their city on fire. See how grave it was of an insult for someone to refuse an invitation that was given. And as far as the bridegroom and his family in chapter 25, these five virgins were refusing to come for something that was considered no sufficient reason. You see what happened in chapter 22? They were killed. You notice also the gravity of the situation is shown by, he tells his slaves, the wedding's ready. Those who were invited weren't worthy. Verse 9, go therefore to the main highways, and as many as you find there, invite to the wedding feast. So those slaves went out into the streets and gathered together all they found, both evil and good, and the wedding hall was filled with dinner guests. Here we see obviously a foreshadowing of the fact that in the rejection of the Jews, Gentiles were going to be the homeless people that were brought into the king's wedding feast for his son. But notice in verse 11, but when the king came in to look over the dinner guests, he saw a man there who was not dressed in wedding clothes. And he said to him, friend, how did you come in here without wedding clothes? And the man was speechless. Then the king said to his servants, bind him hand and foot and throw him into the outer darkness, in that place where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. For many are called, but few are chosen. You see the gravity of the offense of not being ready when the king invites you to come to the feast that is for the bridegroom and the bride. It was such that those who refused the initial invitation were slaughtered by the king. So much so that he asked everybody out there, not just the nobility, but everybody couldn't come on their own terms, and to take the wedding clothes that were offered and refuse to put them on was something that was again considered a capital offense by the king. Because his son himself, his kingdom, was insulted by the fact that here you had someone who, even though he had been given wedding clothes, most likely, had chosen not to put them on. Do you see the gravity of the situation? We don't know the day or the hour that the Lord's coming back, but let me tell you, in spite of the fact that we are those out in the highways and the hedges that have been brought in to be able to be at the wedding feast, the Lord expects us to be ready when He comes back, to have our wedding clothes on, to be those who are dressed in white, who are there with a right relationship with Him and a right attitude, to be able to enjoy the wedding festivities that the Lord has prepared for those that love Him. That last verse in our parable in chapter 25 also says, be on the alert, for you do not know the day or the hour. You not only need to be ready because of the gravity of the situation, but because of the potential brevity of the time that you have to prepare. That's not as big a problem in the third world and in the ancient world where people didn't have clocks and didn't really know what time it was. It's a little more understandable under those circumstances. But here you still had a situation where those who weren't ready were those who were locked out. In fact, it was such an insult that he says, I don't even know you. Do you remember in the 12th chapter of the book of Luke, stories told there about a rich farmer, and he was successful. He was so successful that he decided what he'd do is tear down his barns and build bigger barns and be able to store all his grain and his goods. And then when he had done that, he could say to his soul, soul, and I thought, I've always thought it strange he talked to his soul, but he does. You have many goods. This is verse 19 of Luke 12. You have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, you fool. This very night your soul's required of you. And now who will own what you have prepared? So is the man who stores up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. Here was a man that thought he had all the time in the world and is making all kinds of plans. You remember the ladies in the story in chapter 25 who were there and thought they had more time than they had, or maybe thought that the bridegroom would come earlier than he did and therefore they got lazy and they didn't bring vials of oil, so they were unprepared when he came. Perhaps if it had been longer, they would have been able to take a nice leisurely walk to the oilers and be able to buy oil, but that's not the way it was. They didn't have as much time as they thought they had. And here you have a situation in which the man who's called a rich fool didn't realize how little time he had. Let me tell you a secret. You don't know how much time you have. The Lord could come back before I finish this sermon. Any of us could fall dead before I finish this sermon. I hope that doesn't happen. But do you know, we don't know how long we have to prepare. But do you know, with all the plans that we make, with all the power we think we have to control our schedules and efforts, you may not have much time at all to prepare for the bridegroom coming, and therefore you wind up being inadequately prepared when he does. One other point that I think is worth considering as we look at verse 13 is he says, be on the alert, for you don't know the day or the hour. You need to do that because of the gravity of the situation and the potential brevity of the time to prepare. But you also need to do it because of the finality of the closing of the door. Here were girls that didn't get to spy out potential husbands. Here were those who didn't get to enjoy the wedding feast. Here were those who, because of their insult of the family of the groom, probably were those who were not going to have the relationship with either family that they had had before. And they're closed out. And I think he's not saying, I don't know who you are. He's saying, you are nothing to me now. Because when the time came, you weren't ready. And let me tell you, there's great finality when the Lord comes. Remember in Hebrews 9 and verse 27, it says, for it is appointed unto man once to die, and after that comes judgment. Let me tell you, friends, that is pretty final. That is pretty terminal. We need to make sure we've got plenty of oil to be ready. How are you doing this morning in terms of those things? Because when the Lord comes back, it's a grave insult not to be prepared to meet Him. Especially with all of the revelation that's been given to us in His Word and the importance that the Lord places on the activities of His people in His church. We need to also recognize that your time to prepare is now, and it's only because you have it now and you don't know that you've got tomorrow. And you also need to understand that if you miss this, you have missed it all. If you miss when the bridegroom comes, being prepared, you are locked out for eternity. I know that's a hard concept to wrap your mind around, but while we live in a day and time in which there are all kinds of second chances offered, we, because we have sinned and come short of the glory of God, and because many of us have been bought by the blood of the Lamb, that was our first chance. You know what? There is no second chance. How are you doing today? Do you have your lamps lit? Do you have oil in preparation? Are you somebody who has taken a chance on offending the great judge of all of the earth and not being prepared and putting yourself in a situation in which you are in eternal jeopardy because of such a failure to prepare? Why don't you come forward this morning if you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God? Repent of the things that you've done that are wrong. Confess that Jesus Christ is God's Son, and we can baptize you this morning so that you can leave this place washed in the blood of the Lamb. If you are not prepared after having become a Christian, you need to prepare. You need to go to the oilers. You need to get oil. You need to be prepared because you do not know the day or the hour. Be ready. Because He's certainly coming one day. You don't know when that is. So the only safe way is to be ready now. Think about these things, and if we can help you in your obedience to the Lord this morning, we invite you to come while we stand and sing.